And it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, and on this edition of the program, it's the Mavericks. The Mavericks have a couple of stops in the region very soon, touring with Dwight Yoakam, more a bit later in the program. And when you listen to a Maverick CD or see them in concert, it's such a wide variety of music. Though they're generally labeled as a country band, with them you get multiple genres, all with a common thread, of course. And this is probably what I love about the band. Around since the latest part of the 80s going into the 90s, and I'm joined today by frontman and original member on vocals and guitar, Raul Malo. Of course, I have to hit some of the early stuff, and the thing that really struck me, I will have to admit that about the time that you guys were starting to take in Grammys and really charting in the early to mid-90s, I suppose, that's when I was more immersed into public radio and I was getting more and more into jazz. And even though I grew up just north of Nashville, actually, I was not into any of the local music. It was very much jazz. And so I've been having a great time checking you guys out. And one of the first things that I saw was actually a concert from just a couple of years ago. And I did what we would have called a needle drop, just kind of going through the album, as it were. I went through the concert.
Sure.
And man, every time there was some jazz, and then there was some rock, Tejano, some jazz, yeah. Ska, kind of. I even feel like, yeah, I caught some surf rock kind of things in here as well. So.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, my God. And so this really leads into talking about how you guys got together. I know it was you, and I think it was maybe Robert, getting together from different bands. And so,
right,
were these different types of bands that we hear today, but they were brought together as the Mavericks?
Yeah, man. You know, the Mavericks have certainly evolved. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been several, I think, turning points. I remember going out to California and recording with a group called Los Super Seven, which included people from Los Lobos, people from the Latin world, guys from Oso Motley. It was like sort of an eclectic kind of super group, and it was a beautiful project to be a part of. That kind of opened my eyes to where I wanted to continue to explore, because I always found music is a language, and to me it never really mattered what genre I was. If you're a musician, and if you're a good musician, I'm pretty sure you can sit in with just about anybody. The same goes for jazz guys, to country guys, to Tejano guys, to classical guys. Like, one of my favorite things to do, and we just did it, we just played with the Boston Pops.
Oh, wow.
And it's really fun playing with classical people, because they could let their hair down a little bit with us, and we have to step up our game, too, because those guys are going to be really precise and really good. And so I've always loved the meshing of things, and, I mean, we do have jazz fans in our audience, because some of the music, I don't consider myself a jazz musician. I consider myself a musician. And jazz is one of the art forms that I love and admire, and it's one of the components of the gumbo that we throw together.
So glad you said that word gumbo to describe,
sure,
this kind of thing that you guys produce. And yes, I swear, every time as I was doing that so-called needle drop through the concert, I kept on hearing what I thought was big band, and then I had to stop everything else what I was doing and watch the video and realize you were able to pick up and you were able to produce these thickly textured sounds that make a person think that there's so much more there than there actually is. And that's with the live thing. So I don't know about recording, if you have to layer and layer.
I think it depends. That's the thing. We're not really beholden to any one method. To me, it's like whatever works in the recording. And we have Nico Bolas as our co-producer and confidant in the studio. And we go at it, and we are indulgent. I will say that, you know, and whatever sounds good to us or whatever we think is appropriate for the song, we're going to use. And luckily, I have a band that is okay with all of that. And we like to incorporate different things, and everybody's open to it. As long as it sounds good and it makes us groove, we're in it. And I think that's how we've approached everything.
People talk about different types of music and genres and whatnot, but some of the biggest names in the world have said that there are really only two types of music, and there's good and there's bad, and really it's that's all there is. In the beginning days, you were, I suppose, more of a country band, but I read that you tended to play at more of the rock venues, and I think this was due to some bars or venues wanted more covers. Can you talk about that period?
sure. In those days, you know, we were making it up, honestly, as we went along. Some bars wanted to book a country band, so it's like, okay, yeah, we're a country band. Some bars didn't want to hear anything country, so we still played the same music. It didn't matter. And, you know, eventually the word got out that we were this really good band and we had a following and just let them do whatever the hell they want. And that's what it became. And then through the years, obviously, they were funny because, you know, you were basically adhering to the rules of the night, you know. Yeah. And when you're booked at that level, you're like, yeah, yeah. No covers tonight, boss. No worries. And then, mind you, we did all covers or whatever we wanted to do. It didn't matter. Or no originals is really kind of what the thing was. Mm. It was no originals. That most of the time they wanted covers. And we would play whatever we wanted. And after a while, they realized it didn't matter because we drew people anyways. And at the end of the night, that's what mattered. That people were buying drinks.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, is you're wearing a different sized belt buckle, I suppose, depending on the venues.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Well, on that self-titled debut album, this was, I think, a smaller independent label. You wrote every song on the album, so I'm curious if all of these had been tried and true as you were going around the Miami area, or were these new for the album?
Oh, boy. I think at least most of them probably were tried and true. I mean, I don't think I would have been that brave or even know what I was doing to write a song to put on an album just like that, you know, without having it vetted first, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And so, yeah, you played them out and, you know, then they made it onto the record. And some of them went on to still be played for a while. And then, you know, as you get older, as you outgrow and you learn more and you infuse new music, and then you start having that conversation with your audience. And it depends, you know, what kind of conversation you want to have.
Mm, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, you see what's working, you continue on with that. I keep on speaking to people lately that are close to my own age. That's 58 right now.
Me too.
Oh, excellent. So looking at the days of our childhood, we could listen to AM radio and you would get Kiss followed by the Carpenters, followed by Kenny Rogers, that kind of a thing. You would just go all over the place. It was before radio stations and bars even were that stuck into a genre. I guess I only mentioned that because, again, that's so refreshing that you guys just go all over the place with what a person might say is, oh, no, it's this genre. It has to be this. And no, it doesn't. You guys are having fun and the audience is loving it.
¿Cuántas veces me ha dicho el muy sinvergüenza? Ay, de mi compay, ay, lo voy a matar.
¿Por qué?
Por decirme gato, ya que gato encerrado, y ahora mismo en el acto, te lo voy a...
After that one album, before you were signed to MCA Nashville, this wasn't a case, if I'm not mistaken, of some rep seeing you at a bar and then approaching you, the old, hey, you know, I can make it, I can go off to, you know, whatever. But rather, weren't you invited to perform at some sort of a showcase in Nashville, and then that's where it happened?
Yeah, well, first, before we got invited to Nashville, you know, the buzz was happening about the band because there was a writer at the time, her name is Holly Gleason. He wrote this article about us. It was an industry publication, you know, that everybody read. Mm-hmm. And there was a nice big feature on the band. You got to go see this band and blah, blah, blah. And she had really said some nice things about us. Well, that piqued the interest of certain labels and certain A&R people. And then there were publishers involved. And then before you know it, it became this thing that was percolating. And so all of these wonderful people that came to see us that were really just loving the band and wanted us to succeed. Of course, some of them are vying for business. Some of them are not. Some of them are just in support. But there was a lot of love for this band from the beginning. And man, that led to us getting invited to come up to Nashville and do a proper showcase for MCA Universal. They paid for it back when labels had money for stuff like
that.
Yeah,
right.
That was all she wrote. We got signed to MCA, and that led to the first album and so on and so forth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, and then having representation, just, I guess this was kind of sudden for you guys. I'm sure it was great, but then at this point, were you suddenly then under contractual obligations, X number of songs by X date, and suddenly have to follow a routine that was not your own, maybe?
Well, more than the technical obligations of a contract, what we found stifling after a while was the rigidity of the genre. And being part of a big record label, once they strike gold, they want to strike gold again. And your idea of striking gold may be different than theirs. And to me, it was more important to explore musically what we wanted to do and what we wanted to say rather than repeat past victories. And, you know, we didn't have a victory because we repeated the same thing the first time. You know, we had victories because we were evolving. And, you know, that's still true to us now, which is why we are the way that we have been. You mentioned AM radio. I grew up on AM radio, and I tout the wonders of it. I learned so much driving around with my granddad, just listening to music. And we were able to bond because AM radio, the stuff that I wanted to hear, the new stuff, and they also played a lot of cool old stuff that FM wouldn't necessarily play.
Right.
And so it was an interesting time at radio. And of course, you know, we took it for granted. I didn't think anything of it. I just thought that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
And so as the band evolved and developed, we just didn't feel like anybody should tell us what kind of music we want to play. If it feels good to us and people are coming to see us, I don't care what anybody else thinks. And that's kind of the way we've approached it. And it's, yeah, and I would say there are probably easier paths, I will say,
sure,
you know,
sure.
More commercial paths, paths of least resistance, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody can take what we've done away from us, and we've had a ball doing it.
I'd stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. And afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
You're the primary writer, and I've been loving all the originals on here. You did do a cover, which I would not have expected. That was Frank and Nancy Sinatra's 1967 song, Something Stupid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something Stupid, yeah.
So in the middle of all these originals, of all these this sound and that sound, who was it that said, yeah, Frank Sinatra? No, let's make it even better. His daughter, Nancy.
Well, we had our secret weapon on that one. We had Trisha Yearwood.
Trisha, yeah.
And Trisha's pretty powerful, and she was game for this. And, you know, and I don't even know how that came about, but I'm sure that we were sitting around and we were jamming, and somebody played that, and it sounded great, and Trisha was around, and we sang it at a party. Because in those days, we'd come to town, and, you know, when you're the young, hot band, you know, you're invited to the parties and guitar pulls. Like, that's a real thing, you know, and it still is a real thing in Nashville, where people, you know, it's a potluck night. They bring guitars, and they have jam sessions, or people play songs, and, you know, it's friends, but it's also networking, and it's also kind of fun. And I remember attending a bunch of those early on. Anyways, this probably came out of one of those late nights. And, you know, Trisha's such a great singer, and I had sang on her record. And so we thought we'd return the favor with something a little fun. You know, why not? That we wanted to have fun whenever possible, just throw in something a little quirky or something unexpected. And that one was it. That one certainly is.
I love you. I love you.
Something Stupid, at one point from Frank and Nancy Sinatra. This one from the Mavericks, joined by Trisha Yearwood. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Raul Malo on guitar and vocals and with the Mavericks, appearing with Dwight Yoakam in L.A. and Valley Center quite soon. More a bit later in the program. Just ahead, a touch of the Mavericks' newest release, out quite recently, with all original material. First, though, going back to another cover.
Blue Moon. Without a love of my own, blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
Another that I do have to ask about, because in addition to the eclectic mix that I got on AM radio, I grew up listening to my mom's At the Hop records, so it was doo-wop and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so this is why the Mavericks covering Blue Moon really, really caught me. I read some review saying it was Roy Orbison meets Dean Martin, and I don't know. I just think that was clever wordplay that they were trying to do, but I loved it.
Yeah.
It was a very thinly textured thing, and so, again, there's various versions of this. I forget if this is Rodgers and Hart or Rodgers and Hammerstein, but anyway, this tune came out, and it was originally a ballad, and then the Marcells got hold of it, and that's when we got that bomb-a-da-dom-ba-bomb-ba-bomb, you know, that really, you know, beefing it up. But then you guys took it back to a very relaxed, easygoing. So talk to me about how this one was even decided on, and then I think somebody probably would have also had have said, no, let's keep it thin, let's keep it bare, let's just put it out there gently.
Well, you know what, man? I'm going to give credit to our co-producer on that session, and that was our good buddy, Mr. Nick Lowe.
Mm.
And yeah, I remember the label had reached out to us about doing a song for Apollo 13.
Oh, wow.
A movie. Hmm. And I think they had asked for Blue Moon. And somehow the label brought in Nick Lowe to produce it. I think maybe we requested it. I don't remember the exact makings of that. But it was a really fun session, and Nick did a great job. And he was the one that really based our, I mean, we were kind of doing a similar version already. We were doing Elvis's version, which is very stark. So it's based on the Elvis version. And man, it came out so beautiful. We still play that song, and it's a showstopper, you know? So you never know with a song like that. And, you know, and that was a big movie, of course, Tom Hanks. So that was a nice moment in the history of the band and helped by Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, now this allows me to go from Apollo 13 to Moon and Stars, quite literally now. I just love a good segue, even if I have to write it myself. You guys are currently on the road. You're with Dwight Yoakam on this tour. Now, first of all, is this you guys and Dwight for the whole tour, or you guys are sharing the bill at some places and then separate for others?
Man, I think we're sharing the bill for a lot of places. You know, Dwight has found a good touring partner in us. You know, I think the fans really dig it, and his fans dig having us up there, and we bring our own fans to the proceedings, and so it's an eclectic, beautiful night of music. And we love the tour. We love Dwight. He's a friend, and he's been an inspiration and a musical hero of ours since the beginning, really. I don't think we would have happened had Dwight not happened. literally. Because, you know, I think he happened right around 1990, 1989 is when Guitars Cadillacs came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we were right on those tails, you know, right after that. That's when the Mavericks got signed. So, you know, there's at least a connectivity to the beginning. So it's nice coming full circle after all these years and doing these shows with him, man. It's been great.
And I'm glad you named those dates right there, because I was really trying to work out a timeline as far as who came out when and therefore who would be opening for the other person. But I finally decided you guys had to be sharing the bill. I can't call one person an opener for the other.
Yeah, you know, I think that's how Dwight wants it, although obviously, you know, we defer to him. But yeah, we share the stage. I think that's fair. And Dwight has been more than fair with us. It just works great. You know, we don't have any of that kind of ego stuff like, hey, no, we need to close the show or whatever.
Good.
We don't care.
Nice.
We really don't. Like, are you kidding me? Earlier I play, the better.
There's not a line at Denny's at 2. Okay. Beautiful. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyways, man, it works. It just makes a lot of sense on many levels, and we love it.
Excellent. Excellent.
Am I wasting my time here? Am I just running from my life? Just a day in front of the devil with no angel on my side. They call these back roads the Badlands. A man don't make it here on trust. Just a bunch of busted up Chevys baking in the Tulare dust. And I hear the same old story every morning across my mind as the clock chimes on the hour. I know the years will not be kind. They're burning fast up ahead. They're fading slowly behind. But I'm learning to accept it, that the years will not be kind.
Well, let's look at Moon and Stars. I have a selection of songs that I have to know something about, but this happens to kick off the album, a song called The Years Will Not Be Kind. And even before hearing it, the name Bernie Taupin caught my eye big time. And people would know Bernie Taupin primarily as the co-writer and or lyricist for many of Elton John's biggest hits. And so how did Bernie Taupin become part of the picture with the Mavericks?
At the time, my brother-in-law and he had written a few songs together. Mm. And then my brother-in-law, Wally Wilson, who's the third writer on this song. And then one day, my brother-in-law comes to me and tells me, hey, Bernie's got this song. He wants you in on it. And I think it'd be a good idea. And I'm like, yeah, sure, of course. Are you kidding? I'd be honored. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote that song and we had a great time. And then I ended up demoing the song. And funny enough, now, mind you, we wrote this sometime in the early 2000s, I guess, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And we were originally going to pitch it to Johnny Cash or somebody like that. Anyways, it never got pitched to him. So anyways, fast forward to, I don't know, 2 years ago when we're starting to put this album together and I'm looking for songs. And, you know, I knew that I had a demo of The Years Will Not Be Kind, but I didn't know where it was, so I went looking for it. I found it. I listened to it and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, no wonder we didn't record it. I didn't sound believable. And I'm like, it makes sense, because I remember at the time, I liked the song. I didn't like my demo and I didn't like it for me.
Mm.
I hadn't found my way through it, you know? And that's okay, that happens. Well, fast forward 20 years later, and lo and behold, it fits now like a glove, because it's very true, it's very honest. And it's believable. Now I have wrinkles, I have, you know, gray hair, you know, and it's like I've lost my hair, you know. And so it's very believable and it's very true and it's very honest. And I thought, you know, when we recorded it out in Santa Fe, this sounds like the beginning of a record. And I don't know why. And it always stayed that way. And it's like, man, it's a great way to start this record. And we left it like that.
It is. And I'm always, always curious about sequencing, not only the first song, but the end. And believe me, we'll get to that one as well. Writing with Bernie, I've heard a couple of different takes on the process. Dennis Tufano told me that it was very much a cooperative experience with him, talking about it, finding the flow, then really working, you know, just a real cooperative thing. Now, I'd also read, though, that some of his great, great songs came from a very long, continuous writing, and Elton had to find where to put some breaks in to take this long prose and turn it into a verse, verse, chorus kind of thing.
Sure.
What do you recall with Bernie?
Yeah. You know, whenever you co-write, you know, you're learning, right? You're learning what the strengths of that other person and then vice versa. So as artists, musicians, and singers, the words fall differently on our lips than they do on the songwriters. And when you're dealing with a lyricist, you know, they want to get their point across. And, you know, they have their way to do it and their prose. And that doesn't always coincide with a song, a singable song, you know, or at least as we know it. And so you're going to have those kind of discussions, you know. And so I could see Elton taking some songs and taking the best parts of them and making them work into a singable song, because I've had to do the same, you know, and that's part of the process, you know, and that's okay if you're open to it. Now, if your co-writer is really rigid and this is how it has to stay, well, then, you know, maybe you won't work with that person again or whatever. I don't know. But if you're both into achieving the same goal, then it's a no-brainer. And that's usually how it works.
For this edition of KVC Arts, I've been speaking with Raul Malo, original member of the Mavericks, on vocals and guitar. The Mavericks have a couple of stops nearby, and rather soon, as they tour with Dwight Yoakam. They'll be in L.A. at the Greek Theater July 25th, more at lagreektheater.com. On the 26th, they'll be at Harrah's in Valley Center, more at harrahssocal.com. And more on all of the dates at the Mavericks website, themavericksband.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Raul. And here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Miley Palacios, Sandy Hodela, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Be sure to check out our calendar of events in the region at our homepage, kvcrnews.org, or you can go directly there at kvcrnews.org/calendar. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.